Hi there and welcome to the latest edition of The Front Page, in which this week we will be looking at calls for Constitution Hill to race more. We'll be examining the latest Cheltenham Festival entries and asking what they tell us about the diminishing number of high-class horses trained in Britain. And we'll be reflecting on an explosive interview with ARC Chief Executive Martin Cruddas, who was strikingly transparent on a number of major industry matters, including the fact that when it comes to revealing more information about ARC's media rights income, he has no intention of being more transparent. In the need for transparency, I should tell you that I remain and continue to be Lee Mottershead, and I'm joined by my esteemed Racing Post colleagues, Maddie Playle and Chris Cook. Hello to you both.
Hi, Lee.
Are we well?
Yeah, very well. Really enjoyed the racing at Warwick over the weekend.
Yes.
Great competitive handicaps, lots of runners, and some great stories as well, which always sort of brightens the mood when you get a good story like James Best winning the Classic Chase on My Silver Lining.
Yeah, it was a good story. Chris, I know you're a Warwick fan, you like the place. I'd not been there for a few years, and I was really struck by how much I enjoyed it. It's got a lot of charm about it.
Yeah, I mean, for all you actually lose sight of them over the back straight for a little because of that hill in the middle.
Yeah.
It seems to have sort of quite a good enthusiastic constituency. There's always lots of people who turn up and support it. You know, not just the big days as well.
Yeah.
Whenever I turn up there, I have a good time. It's sort of a tiny little track, really. There's not a huge amount of space to put your spectators.
No.
But maybe that promotes the sort of feeling of the atmosphere that you're all in it together. It's good fun. And I managed to back a winner on Saturday as well. So
I did not manage to back a winner on Saturday. And I can also say with some certainty that Constitution Hill will never be appearing at Warwick, unless maybe one day they change their mind about going over fences. Well, realistically, it's not going to happen, is it? But where Constitution Hill does and doesn't run has been a story in recent days, as Maddie Playle will explain.
Yes, so we had two main pieces I want to focus on here. Firstly, our good colleague Richie Forrest, or Irish editor, wrote a piece basically just expressing his frustration about how we aren't seeing Constitution Hill. Ironically, we're not seeing his constitution tested, and he's going to breeze through his small number of assignments this season, and we're not really going to see what he's capable of. And then your magnificent, if I may say myself, interview with David Ellsworth, which I really enjoyed.
Bless you.
Made me laugh and smile and even tear up a little bit, so I would urge anyone to read that who hasn't already. He also sort of expressed his frustration, saying that, you know, comparing Constitution Hill's career to greats like Desert Orchid, of course, who he trained to win many handicaps, giving stones of weight away in a different variety of races. Lots of collective frustration surrounding the campaigning of Constitution Hill last week. I think, first up, it's a scenario which frustrates me as a fan and as a race goer, but I think the more you look into it, the more your frustration can be tempered a little bit. Firstly, and this is a point that Chris is going to touch upon later on in the show, there aren't that many good two-mile hurdlers around. If Constitution Hill were to run in the international, he is so good and there's a dearth of talent, really, that he would likely find it a procession once again. So I don't think you can blame Nicky Henderson for that.
No.
And secondly, you know, if he were to run in a race like the Betfair Hurdle, which I would love to see, and that's the sort of campaigning that David Ellsworth suggested, we would really get to learn more about his talent, seeing him give weight away. How many runners would there be in a Betfair Hurdle with Constitution Hill off his rating in the field? I mean, there can't be that many that would go for it, and the rest would be rendered well and truly out of the weight. So I'm not sure that's the great idea some people seem to think it is, because you probably wouldn't be left with much of a horse race at all. Although, I confess, I would love to see it, and it would be much better than seeing him, you know, cant around in a three-runner trial somewhere.
There'd be some who would give it a go.
I think so,
there, you know. I think if they were all at the handicap, I think...
You think they'd still...
Because, you know, it's solid prize money, isn't it? Even if you're only running for second.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Do you think the field
would fill, though?
Oh, no, I don't think it probably would fill. But there would be that sense of, you know, this is like a once-in-a-lifetime chance to take on this horse, getting a stone in 10 or whatever it would
be.
There'd be trainers like Gary Moore and hopefully Paul Nicholls who sort of be picking up that gauntlet, I think.
And I think that is the answer because, as I've said, there aren't that many good horses around. So in order to see him in a scenario where he could be tested, handicaps are what we need. I think the thing that is frustrating for racing fans is the communication. And I've been a critic of Nicky Henderson before when it comes to this sort of thing, pulling horses out due to the ground and particularly referencing welfare. I think you can't conflate those things. I think that's a very dangerous road to go down. Mm. But he has tried to do his best by the sport by telling everyone what his rough plan is for the horse at the start of the season. Now, there are extenuating circumstances with the Fighting Fifth, of course, because it was moved to Sandown, it was on terrible ground, etc., etc. And there are, again, with this international hurdle, because he might not have Nico de Boinville. I think he probably will now.
But that at wasn't the time, a factor.
It wasn't a factor.
Yeah, that's what he says. That's not a factor.
Okay. Well, I'm not sure I thoroughly buy that. Okay. I'm sure it could have been at some point of time, anyway. And you know, the spacing of the races, if he wants to go to Aintree or Punchestown, etc., etc. But for Nicky, I almost wish he'd try and help us out a little bit less and maybe not tell us exactly what he's planning to do at the start of the season, because then inevitably when the horse doesn't turn up at one of those things, due to these changing factors, people are going to get frustrated. He's not the first trainer to do it, but I think that communication is the thing that's frustrating. If you say to people, Constitution Hill's going to run in this race, this race, this race, this race, they're going to go, right, yeah, great, I'm so excited. And then when something changes, as it does in sport and as it does it with racehorses, people are going to get downbeat. Mm. I wish there was some more, you know, ambition perhaps behind the campaigning of him, and I wish everything wasn't so Cheltenham-centric. But ultimately, I guess, on the other chance, there's only one horse who we really want to see him up against, and that's State Man. And the chances of State Man coming to England or Constitution Hill going to Ireland seem pretty slim. So handicap's the answer. And also, I think we know how the sport has been rendered very Cheltenham-centric and Cheltenham-obsessed, etc., etc. And I do think that's to the detriment of it. But I guess there's another way of looking at it, to say that it actually helps build a narrative around the whole season that the champion hurdle is when State Man and Constitution Hill clash.
Yeah.
If they were clashing every weekend, it wouldn't be a particularly special spectacle to see them both clash heads at Cheltenham.
Well, I suppose the difference is in the old days, when Quinn, Chris and I were lads, in the old days, horses like that might well have clashed with the winter, but often they'd have been clashing in handicap races. And then you got to Cheltenham and you actually found out who the best horse was because they were being...
Yeah.
And I think with the Constitution Hill story here, what seems to have sparked it is this international hurdle that you referenced. Obviously, the race was moved from mid-December to late January, a more obvious place in the calendar. And there had been suggestions that they were very up for running the horse in that race. And then Nicky has suggested in a local media interview with regional media in Newbury that it would have to be overwhelmingly clear that it was the right thing to do to run the horse in the race. And at this point, he's not.
I think as well, the wording of these things irks me slightly. You know, the right thing to do.
Yeah.
How does one define that? Well,
so, I mean, I would think what's in his mind surely is the real possibility of getting deep ground at Cheltenham on that day. Yeah. And then it's sort of close enough to Cheltenham. You see it in particular with the 3-mile chasers, you know, the ones that have a hard race that day.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, quite often are not then at their best for the festival. I think it would be a bit different with a 2-mile hurdler. You've got a much better chance. Of
more stamina covering track, isn't it, the new course
and
as well?
And also, though, but how do we know that's not going to suit him? You know, how do we know deep ground?
It might suit him on the day, but then it takes longer to recover from. I think that's what he's worried about. I think Nicky's one of those trainers, he lives so much on his nerves.
He does,
He'd just rather not have that stress.
But let's be honest, this is a horse who's never really come off the bridle in his life. So,
I suppose,
how do we know how he's going to bounce back from a tough race?
I wonder if there are factors about Constitution Hill in particular and in terms of how he takes his races. Because if you look at a parallel, so Nicky is looking forward to running John Bond on Saturday at Ask in the Clarence House Chase. He said if that meeting happens to be abandoned, shock headlines, weather's not great this week. If it's abandoned, he's more than prepared for the horse to go to Cheltenham the following week if he gets rearranged. So he's not bothered about running John Bond at Cheltenham. So I was wondering if maybe there are things about Constitution Hill in terms of how he takes his races, maybe they take more out of him than maybe we appreciate, and that's a consideration for when he wants to run the horse.
Jeremy Scott was saying on Look on Sunday, wasn't he, that there's a whole different pressure that comes with training winners and horses at Cheltenham these days. He thinks that's what's changed from Elsie's day.
I'm sure.
Although there was an element of pressure then, it's a different intensity now. And as you say, Chris, I think Henderson's, the way he operates is very much to live, and he doesn't enjoy that pressure at all. And he's seen how it's ruined horses, in his definition, ruined horses before with the likes of Altior when he had that great big battle, etc., etc.
Well, yeah, I mean, that took a lot out of both of those horses. Exceptional circumstances there, but yeah, you can see why he'd be gun-shy about that happening again. But I think probably in the older days, it was really difficult to win at Cheltenham, so there could be no expectation, and you could be relatively cavalier about it, couldn't you? But now, he's already 3s on, isn't he, Constitution Hill for the Champion Hurdle. Everyone expects him to win, and therefore, as the trainer of that horse, you experience that. It's a huge volume of pressure. You can really only muck it up, because you're not going to get any credit for getting him to win another Champion Hurdle. You know, as a star.
I almost think, in certain scenarios, the best thing to happen would if these horses were beaten, because it takes the pressure off everyone.
Well, yeah.
And then they're not going to be so afraid to be beaten because they've already been beaten before. Well, there's this obsession with unbeaten records at the moment, and I think it's really damaging. I don't like it.
That's one of the points that David was making. And funny, the Constitution Hill subject was one that he very much wanted to raise, and we set up the interview. It was something he picked up then that he wanted to talk about. And he did talk about how in the old days, with Desert Orchid, with Arkell, with the great greats, they did get beat, but he said that we always wanted to win, but we weren't afraid of losing. I don't think there's, well, again, the danger that you sound right or fogey, but I don't think that there is much doubt in my mind that jump racing was better in those days, in the sense that you did get the best horses running more regularly. You did have more of the best races were limited handicaps, which I think made them more interesting. Elsie references the fact that the Tingle Creek was a limited handicap in those days. What is now the Clarence House was a limited handicap. The Game Spirit Chase was a limited handicap. You had certainly among the 2 mile chases and the 3 mile chases, fewer conditions, weight for age options, which meant that Cheltenham in some ways mattered more because it was actually where you did find out who the very best horse was. But I know from having been on the Jumps review group that we did make some changes. The Desert Orchid Chase became a limited handicap, but there is only so much you can do, and you have to work within the art of the possible at any given time. One thing I do think I'd hope with Constitution Hill and the International Hurdle is if they're not going to run him and they make a decision some way out from next Saturday, because I just wonder if they said this week, we've decided that it's for the horse's best interest to go straight to Cheltenham. We've got State Man and Perry Pass and Bob Ollinger looking towards the Irish Champion Hurdle. I just wonder if the connections of one of those horses might think if Constitution Hill isn't going to International Hurdle, they might bring him to Cheltenham. Because if they don't...
Bob Ollinger came over.
Exactly, yeah. Because if they don't, one reason why we're so desperate for Constitution Hill to run is that the other British 2 mile hurdlers, they ain't very good.
And so they're like the worst of all possible worlds is if it looks like he's going to run and then he doesn't. And he scared everything away, or you know, what little there is, and you end up with not much of a race.
Yeah.
It's a problem, isn't it?
Yeah. It's communication, I think, a lot of it. And also, Chris, I'm interested to see what you've got to say later, because I do think this is worse over hurdles. I'd need to look into the stats to see if that backs it up. But, I mean, you look at this weekend, you've got a horse, weather permitting, like Royal Pagai, who's going to go for his third Peter Marsh chase off a big weight. L'Empresse won a rehearsal chase off a big weight. Stage Star won the Paddy Power off a big weight. It seems that over fences, for whatever reason, we're seeing it a little bit more with horses rolling, trainers rolling the dice for horses at the top of the handicap.
Should we go and talk about something completely different? We do actually in a second. Before we do that, I need to tell you that we have a spectacular offer regarding the Racing Post Members Club. This is that offer. Welcome back to part two of The Front Page. We have debated Constitution Hill Now we're going to move on to another of British Racing's biggest figures, Martin Cruddas, the chief executive of the Arena Racing Company, who gave a whopper of an interview to our industry editor, Bill Barber, last week. Now, Bill spoke to Martin a few days in advance of the interview. That's often what happens with interviews, not sort of the day before the piece. In his comments, Martin initially painted a pretty gloomy picture of the British racing landscape as he sees it financially at the moment, saying that the affordability checks are already having even more of an impact than he had previously spoken about. He was pretty negative about his beliefs regarding whether the government will row back on affordability checks. And he pointed out that because of the financial impact of checks, that ARC had put a pause on all capital expenditure and that prize money in 2024 would be stagnant relative to 2023. So not really a huge amount of good news there from Martin, but he was being honest as he sees the landscape. He then went on in the interview to talk about how he had forgiven BHA Chief Executive Julie Harrington for throwing in a grenade on the subject of transparency at the Gimcrack dinner in York. But Martin, within the interview, threw in plenty of grenades himself. We know that the subject of transparency in relation to media rights is a red hot topic for racing's participants. Many of them have been vocal about wanting to see racecourses be more transparent in terms of what they're earning from media rights and what they're putting from that money into prize money. Well, Martin, and I'll reference a few quotes here in the piece, said in relation to suspicions that media rights cash is being squirreled away, he said, "It's very difficult to argue with people who leave rational thought at the door. I won't engage with those people." He said, "What I'm not ever going to allow is for a trainer or an owner to tell this company how it should be run and what it should spend money on." He said, "Those racecourses that say we give 100% of our media rights to prize money demonstrate a level of economic naivety that would be embarrassing for a five-year-old." And he said that claims or calls for trainers to boycott races at ARC collectively would be completely and utterly illegal and would be challenged. Subsequent to Martin Cruddas' interview with Bill Barber, Nevin Truesdale of the Jockey Club announced that they were taking a different position to ARC. They already had done, because the Jockey Club has had a round of transparency meetings with racing's participants. He said that they would be increased in 2024 and that the Jockey Club would be providing more information regarding its media rights income to the Thoroughbred Group. Members of the Thoroughbred Group were not surprisingly very critical of what Martin Cruddas has said and the tone of his comments. And interestingly, on the day that the Martin Cruddas interview came out, ARC and Martin Cruddas were interviewing trainers in Berkshire prior to a day of shooting the following day. You'd like to have been a fly on the wall or in the sky when that was taking place. So really interesting industry stuff last week. Chris Cook, you've written plenty about media rights, about Martin Cruddas, about major industry matters.
Have I?
For a long time, incisive stuff. First of all, sort of putting to one side whether you think that what Martin was saying was correct, were you surprised he said it in the way he said it?
I don't know if I was surprised. I mean, he's long been very frankly spoken, outspoken. I'm just noticing, actually, while you're talking there, how like Michael O'Leary he's sort of become.
Yes.
You know, because yes. he's very outspoken, quite pejorative in his comments about his rivals in argument. And, of course, he can point to his own record of strong business success. You know,
yeah,
much like O'Leary
absolutely.
Can, you know, to anyone who criticises or doubts him. I understand his point, but I do think that we've been stuck on this particular issue of transparency over media rights income for so long. We're just, as a sport, we're not going to be able to move forwards without an actual answer, you know, some kind of transparency from a range of racecourses about how they're managing that side of their business. And I mean, we're not expecting them to publish all of their figures in the Racing Post, but they've got to figure out some way or other of showing to the other people in, you know, power brokers and horse racing, that actually they don't have as much left to spend as people seem to think, or maybe the reverse will turn out to be true. I think the Jockey Club are doing the right thing. You know, they're trying to sort of smooth feathers and placate people and get people on board and build alliances, rather than, you know, doing the Martin Cruddas thing of sort of waving your sword around and saying, you can all go to hell.
It does feel as though ARC are going to be ever more exposed on this. If the Jockey Club are being, and they have been, more transparent, the Thoroughbred Group are talking about how they're already speaking to some of the large indies. They've spoken to York, they're looking to speak to Ascot, Newbury, Goodwood, etc. Julie Harrington, as I said before, said the Gimcrack speech, she would like to see more transparency. I mean, Martin is never worried about being a lone wolf and
sure,
playing his own game.
And I dare say he's got the backing of the owners.
Absolutely. I suppose in his position, that's all that matters.
He says that more or less in as many words in the article, doesn't he?
Maddie, what was your take on it?
I can't help but think, when we're talking about such a touchy subject as media rights, that to come out and say things in the way that he did, as you say, Chris, very Michael O'Leary-esque, it's just going to anger people and it's just going to frustrate people. And I agree that approach is it's entertaining in a way. And as you say, he's serving his own interests. But
seems to have worked for him in business for
a good long time.
And, you know, that's often the right approach. But equally, it can go the other way. We've seen certain trainers come forward. I know the Leeches are one. Mm-hmm. Christian and Sophie Leech are saying that they're going to boycott ARC tracks, and their owners fully support that now. So I'm not sure that would be the case if he'd come out and said it in a slightly different way. I was a little bit surprised, and I think transparency is needed in this area. We don't need, you know, every last detail, but equally, like you, Chris, I can't see how we move forward from an issue that is so integral to racing's finances and how the sport is run without learning more about it, knowing more about it. We know so little.
It feels like the discussions are hampered by the immense amount of mistrust that there is now between horsemen and racecourses.
Yeah.
Some racecourses more than others.
Sure. Yeah. But I mean, that I think is why the sort of the Jockey Club approach is probably the one that's going to help us in the long term.
But Martin made a good point that's been made elsewhere, in that it's not a one-size-fits-all thing, is it? So for ARC, media rights is basically their business model. I think he says something along the lines of only less than 100 meetings at ARC would make a profit were it not for media rights. Where you have some of the bigger tracks, all the Jockey Club tracks, their model is more built on attendances.
He's got a line in that article, doesn't he, which is almost like a little shot at the Jockey Club, full of jealousy, saying, well, you know, wouldn't I just love to have these 5-day meetings where people are spending more than £100 a head, 60,000 of them rolling through your gates. But that's just not ARC's typical kind of fixture, is it? So it has to be about betting turnover for them.
What consequences might this have? Michael Duggar, chief exec, soon to be chair of the BGC, said, simply bankrolling media rights shareholders without making racing more attractive is not a sustainable business model for the sport. It comes at a time when we know bookmakers and British racing leaders are looking at reforming the levy. There were suggestions that this wouldn't have been helpful with that regard. Could this have consequences?
Well, let's get Bill Barber on the show to give us the definitive answer on that one. I mean, I'd be very worried about the racing appearing, you know, disunited when we're trying to sort of persuade the government to help us out. But then, you know, the government's got problems of its own, and we may find that we're talking to a different government in a relatively short period of time. So, I mean, there's all sorts of problems with that particular subject already.
Slightly off piece, but one thing I'd like racing to focus on is the experience that you get when you go to a race course and really trying to boost attendances. When I was out in Canada last year, actually, at Woodbine, the magnificent huge racetrack, but the amount of spectators actually coming through the gates was so minimal. I think they raced from Thursday through to Sunday. And of course, their big international meeting, there was a great crowd there. But otherwise, it was absolutely bleak. And I think the prospect of that happening on British race courses, because you know, the model is moving further towards wagering and betting is a really sad thing. Is a really sad thing, and I think
full of danger, that, isn't it?
Exactly, and I think we can learn from that, and we should be seeing, you know, the likes of, I think, Sotheby's, when they had their storm damage.
Yeah.
They were only allowing certain members in and certain people in, etc. And during COVID, obviously, we have racing behind closed doors. I just think these things are all pointing towards how we need to focus on getting people back on a race course, enjoying racing and connecting with that side of the sport. You know, have a bet while you're there, of course, but I think that prospect of having blank race courses and everyone betting from remotely is sad and dangerous.
Yeah. And you were writing about this in the context of Kempton quite recently, talking about how it's sort of been allowed to become unlovely and it's unloved. Yeah. I would think it's tied in some way to the fact that they put the all-weather track in there, and obviously for a lot of those race meetings, it's going to be about betting turnover, right? But that's been allowed to sort of become the attitude to the whole of Kempton as a business. You know, it just doesn't seem to have had the investment that one might expect for a track of its status and situation. I still love going there, and they've got some great jump racing there, but I mean, it doesn't get the sort of volume of attendance that you would like to think for a track, you know, just outside London. You wonder if it's being supported enough with advertising and if its facilities are being sort of kept up to code. I really worry if we let that slide, because when you have a lot of people coming through the gates, you know, we always brag about how we're the second biggest spectator sport after football in the country, and you know, maybe that position is in peril. It shows relevance, doesn't it, when you're dealing with things like government. You know, if you get a large number of people coming through the gates consistently, it shows that you still matter to lots of individual people. And, you know, I think if you're just pointing to number of people who bet on your races, that has relatively less impact.
Just before we move on from Martin Cruddas, again, one of the things he did talk about was, say, affordability checks and where we are with those. He's been one of those who, within British Racing, has been front and centre at negotiating, if you like, with government trying to take a change. We learned last week that there will be a debate in Parliament on affordability checks late February, probably in Westminster Hall. That's a positive sign, so long as, I suppose, that debate is well attended, the right things are said, and the government actually takes notice.
Yeah, exactly that. Hopefully, racing is still good enough at lobbying that we can get a good turnout of MPs who know how much racing matters and know how much racing is being affected by these the checks that are actually been in place for quite some time now in reality. And hopefully, you know, the voices will be expressed there that will force the government to listen. But I mean, again, we're into a sort of election campaigning year, and you just wonder, you know, if how far down the agenda a subject like this might have slipped, you know, whether it's going to make any difference at all.
Yeah, I think that's a fair point too. And before we move on, finally, well done again to Bill Barber. That was a sensational interview. If you've not read it yet, have a look on the Racing Post digital platforms, or seek out your copy of the Racing Post from last week. Before we go on to part three of the show, I can inform you that we have an exciting offer in relation to free bets. This is it. Okay, welcome back. Part three then of the Front Page Now, and leading our discussions is Mr. Chris Cook.
Yeah, so we got some Cheltenham Festival entries last week, and the headline really is the extent to which these show power moving away from Britain and towards Ireland. I mean, no surprise there, but just the extent of it is shown by the fact that we've got 22 possible runners in the Champion Hurdle, of which 13 are trained in Ireland. Obviously, the big one is in Lambourne. But basically all of his serious rivals are in Ireland, and you know, all the up-and-coming ones. The overall entry isn't bad. It's 22, which is just below the 10-year average of 25. P Pete Scargill did some interesting work in the Front Runner newsletter last week, sort of breaking down the numbers of quality horses in British jump racing. He sort of using figures published every so often by the BHA. He had a look at the number of horses in Britain that are rated 151 or above. That's the sort of top class bracket in jump racing. You go back only as far as 2020, there were 95 horses in that bracket based in Britain. Now there's 47. I mean, that's, you know, that's a precipitous drop in just over 3 years. That's like half. And again, he breaks them down. So the number in Ireland, I should say, is over 70 now. So they're way ahead in terms of top quality horses. And in terms of percentage, I can't find the figures exactly, but basically they're a lot younger in Ireland than they are here. We've got, you know, a larger proportion of our horses rated above 150 or sort of nine or over, and presumably on the decline.
Badly about Not So Sleepy, not on this show.
No, fair enough. I mean, Not So Sleepy counts as a really serious, top class hurdler. If only we had a few more like him.
Yeah, we need him.
It shows a continuing narrative. It shows that we're not acquiring the bare raw material that we really need for top class jump racing in this country. You know, something has changed. Several things have changed, probably. But whatever the reason, British racing is not getting enough of the good stuff that it needs to support a major event like the Cheltenham Festival. And it suggests to me that you're going to see more and more as time goes by of, all of those trophies going overseas, basically.
Isn't it the case that the Stayers Hurdle is the only championship race so far at the Cheltenham Festival where there are more British entries than Irish entries?
That could be.
I mean, all the steeplechase races, there's more Irish horses.
Yeah.
Obviously, only nine Maddie British trained hurdlers entered in the champion hurdle.
It doesn't surprise me, though.
No.
Does it surprise you?
No, they're not there, are they?
Having watched British racing for the last couple of years, you've seen this transition quite starkly play out right in front of us. And a lot of people sort of say, oh, is it cyclical? And it could be. There was a time when we had the, Corso Stars, the Denman, Celestial, Halos, Twist, Magics, all those wonderful Paul Nicholls trained horses. And now the momentum seems to have shifted over to Nicky Henderson a little bit when it comes to the very, very top notches. He had Altior, Shishkin, now Constitution Hill, etc. But it doesn't surprise me at all. And it's a shame when I grew up watching racing, it was just so different. And considering, without wanting to be mean, but I'm a bit younger than you two, that such a change can be measured in that time.
I'm not sure that needed to be said.
No, such a change can be seen in that time.
Yeah. Because we were talking
even
about
from when I've been involved.
We were talking about the Gold Cup entries the week before. I think there were more British trained runners in the Gold Cup a dozen years ago than there are entries now 2 months before the race.
Yeah.
That's pretty stark stuff. The bottom line is I don't really mind where these horses are trained as long as we get a sufficient number of them actually turning up and making a proper race of it. It does tend to suggest that, something's rotten in Denmark. We've lost a knack that we used to have. Surely there are trainers
What's
who can
solution?
Do the job in this country.
You're someone who thinks of ideas. I know you've long been an advocate of changes to the Grand National in terms of the amount of runners that certain people can have.
Sure.
What would the Chris rule change be here?
Well, you have to be careful with rule changes, trying to fix everything. I do regret the fact that everybody's sort of gravitating towards a much smaller number of trainers than ever they used to. I mean, when I started getting into jump racing, I think, if you were an owner who'd got hold of a couple of horses, you'd send them to the guy who was down the road. You wanted them trained locally so you could go and see your horses. And these days, the really big time owners have much deeper pockets than, the owners of racehorses in the 80s. It's nothing to them if they've got to fly to Ireland to go and see their horses, or they can, watch them on all manner of modern technology devices. Lots of British-based owners are perfectly happy to have their horses trained in Ireland, which would never have crossed their minds sort of 30 or 40 years ago. And of course, so many of these horses are bred in Ireland. That was always the case. I mean, one problem, I think, is that Britain has just never got good enough actually breeding, you know, top quality jumps horses. You know, it's there to some extent, that industry, but it's never punched on anything like the same.
Do you think it's because Ireland have fostered their grassroots so much? This is a thing that I've written about before. If you look at the national and sire roster, you know, most of them are standing in Ireland, a couple in France, and even then they seem to be migrating over. We've seen it this season to Ireland. So they're going to have closer proximity to those raw materials. The people involved on the ground are going to be better at identifying the talent when they're produced in the way that they are now, which I think is fair to say has changed a lot in the last 20 years. Yeah. You know, a point-to-point horse now is not the same beast it probably was 20 years ago. It's become quite commercial, and producing them, as we know, there's six figures, if not more, involved in that. So I think
the interesting thing is that not all the horses that sort of work their way through and become Cheltenham winners are hugely expensive graduates from the sort of point to point seat.
Precisely.
I mean, you know, Willie Mullins has, you know, he's really refined that to a sort of high standard. You know, that ability to go out and find these promising young horses that are going to be champions. It's highly impressive. And you have to take your hat off to what he's achieved. Personally, I wish decades ago someone had the foresight to say, you know, we should put a limit on the extent to which any one stable can grow, because you don't, from a spectator's point of view, I don't think you do want any one stable to become as mighty as Willie Mullins and Gordon Elliott have become. You could even say, arguably, Nicky Henderson and Paul Nicholls in this country. The sport is more attractive when lots of people are fighting their corner and can win.
Just one last point on the absence of horses and the point that you said, Chris, about you need them to turn up. Warwick on Saturday, Edward Courage Cup was changed to a novice handicap chase the first time because in previous runnings as an open handicap chase, it hadn't been getting many runners. On this occasion, it had two runners, open novice handicap chase. One was rated 127, one was rated 124. At Warwick's previous meeting, the novice chase was a walkover, 2 mile novice chase. In a sense, that highlights the problem. And Warwick's reaction, perfectly understandable, is that next year we might change a race completely or just make it a 0 to 120 handicap chase, because if we do that, we're more likely to get runners.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a perfectly understandable reaction from any race course. I think maybe as a sport we have to look at adopting a policy of, you know, if a race produces such unsatisfactory fields, you just don't run the damn thing. Yeah. And you know, that will sort of focus people's minds on making sure that what we're actually putting out there is entertaining, and not just, you know, sort of two or three horses taking each other on for what was probably a decent amount of prize money. I mean, it's
First prize £10,562, second prize £4,860, and because Richard Hoyles was explaining this to me on Saturday, I didn't know this, but when a race only has, say, for example, two declared runners at the declaration stage, the race course can then keep the money it would have paid for, say, for example, the third and fourth. Whereas if there
that's a question I asked a while ago and I don't think I got the answer to, so that's very interesting.
But if there'd been three runners declared
and
then one had come out, then the third prize money would have been, but quite understandably, the race course can keep back money that it would have paid out to third and fourth, the third and fourth don't get declared to run.
At some stage, you'd think horsemen are going to cotton onto that and declare horses that don't turn up, but the money still has to be paid out. Is anyone that Machiavellian? I'm sure they must be. But it slightly defies logic that there would be, you know, decent money available for a race like that, and there must be horses that are qualified to run.
Well, it's produced Cheltenham Festival winners, I think, in the last couple of years. I think Sky Pirate won it before winning the Grand Annual.
Yeah, but this year became a novice handicap for the first time.
Well, that's
but
what I'm saying. Maybe that change wasn't the wisest change to make. Maybe, I don't know, maybe next year it'll have a full field.
Ironically, it was made because it had been deemed to be a failing race. And it wasn't
when it
getting
had
enough
sort
runners.
Of six or seven runners,
I
mean, the bottom line is if people don't support these races, they're just going to disappear, unfortunately.
Yeah, use them or lose them. And do keep watching, please, the front page in future weeks. We'd hate to disappear because we love being here and we intend to carry on being here. And at the end of this week's show, I have to reveal who has the winning story. Well, I think the story I presented, the Martin Cruddas interview story, was a whopper-oony of a story, technical industry racing term. But on this occasion, I'm going to not give myself the winning story, because I've said before in this chair I have a big guilt complex. Maddie, I think the Constitution Hill story is really interesting, and it paints a picture of a problem with British racing, but perhaps it's just one part of a bigger problem that Chris presented in his story about the Cheltenham Festival entries and the absence of high-class British trained horses. Therefore, Mr. Cook, you are the winner.
Amazing scenes.
Amazing scenes. Congratulations to Chris, and well done to Chris. Thank you to Chris for joining us. Thank you, Maddie, for joining us. Thank you for joining us. We shall return next week. Until then, stay wrapped up warm, enjoy your racing if it's on, and see you soon. Bye-bye.